Style section, bar and club guides, and more. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace. Tune in worldwide at kpft.org.
Welcome to So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only here on KPFT, Houston's Community Radio. I am your host, Hank Rubicek, and along with the best team on radio, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Tatiana Gago, Eric Heen, Chrissy Gorman, and Harwood Taylor, we celebrate the power of story by inviting storytellers to take us on astonishing journeys through windows of their souls. You know, So What's Your Story is a platform for storytellers. So we like to spotlight those who can entertain, engage, and move us with aplomb. And I've got a terrific example of one tonight. Friend and past guest, Justin Dice. A Michigan native, this seasoned educator is a tutor at Advantage Testing of Houston, where he helps students with academic and college prep work, including testing for college admissions. Traveling, cooking, rowing, and watching Frasier reruns are among his other interests. But it's Justin's striking sense of a good story that impressed me most when I ambushed him at the Moth a few years ago to be on this program that shines as his true talent. He's won the Moth Story Slams a few times as well as a Grand Slam. It's no surprise because Justin blends inspiring themes with dynamic delivery to create a memorable experience for anyone fortunate enough to be within an earshot. I help students with college entrance essays, and I notice differences in writing patterns, Justin, and content and the like, and I consider you to be an essential worker. And it's really challenging to answer this in a few moments, but I'm curious, has the pandemic in any way changed your role as a tutor? I know that you are typically seeing people in person, but online, any changes?
I think, you know, the basics of what we do hasn't changed much, but I think in a time of, it's a bit more unsettled maybe for students, there's more uncertainty as to, college, policies and how those are changing. Playing the role of maybe the mentor a little bit, is a change that I've had to make and enjoyed making.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I have found that to be true, teaching online. It really does change the role. The roles are the same, but the tasks are sometimes a lot different. Well, let's get to the stories. You have comedy and tragedy for us tonight, and I really look forward to revisiting a couple of older tales and pretty excited about your newer slate. Let's begin with what I consider to be vintage Justin all the way. And I think that this is a story that every teacher, every student, or any human being with a pulse will really enjoy. And it's called Talking to Myself. Let's hear it.
Thanks, Hank. So this story takes place when I was a brand new teacher. My first year teaching, I was warned by my more senior colleagues that I would experience something called the honeymoon period. And they said that for every new teacher, for the first couple of weeks of school, students would be really well-behaved. They'd be attentive, they would do their work. But they said, don't be fooled by this. Really what's happening is they're trying to, they're feeling you out. They're trying to get a sense of who you are. And a couple weeks in, they're going to start testing you. They're going to start pushing you to see what they can get away with. And they said, if you want to have any control over your classroom this year, you have to pass that test. So, couple weeks into school, it was my first hour English class, and one of my students, Tim, walked in about 15 minutes late. I was in the middle of a lecture, and I wasn't that surprised to see Tim walk in late. I think I'd seen him just a handful of times in the first couple weeks of school, typically late. Tim was the star baseball player at the school. and sports were a really big deal at this place. So I got the sense when I met Tim that he felt that I was privileged to be breathing the air that he did. So Tim saunters in. He has his late pass from the office. He tosses it at me without really looking at me, walks back to the back of the room, sits down next to his buddy, and starts talking to him so loudly that the entire class can hear. And this while I'm in the middle of a lecture. And so I stop things. I think, or I say, Tim, excuse me, I'm sorry, but we've gone over this. These are the expectations. You know, while I'm teaching, you guys aren't talking. And so if you have anything to say, that'll have to wait. And Tim stops his conversation long enough to turn to me, look me dead in the eye, turn back to his friend and keep talking. And you could feel in that moment the air in the classroom change. It started to crackle a little bit. And all of my other students looked at Tim, and they turned and they looked at me, and they looked at Tim, and they looked at me. And I realized that this was the test that I had to pass. So I walked back through the row of desks, and again, all the heads are turning with me. I get back to Tim's desk, and I say, excuse me, but Tim, that's incredibly rude. Just look at me and keep going, right? We've talked about this. You can't do that. That's absolutely inappropriate. And Tim looks back at me. And he's a pretty big guy, maybe 6'4", 220. And he starts to get a little worked up. He says, what's your problem? You got something to say to me? What? Don't say anything to me. Get out of my face. I don't want you in my face. Go talk to yourself. Well, you always got something to say to me. You're always talking to me. I don't want to hear it. Go talk to yourself. Don't talk to me. Go talk to yourself. So I think for a moment. I look down at Tim and I smile and I say, okay. He gives me this look like, and I turn and I walk back up to the front of the room. I turn to face the class and I pause for a moment. I turn to my right and I say, Mr. Dice, what are we going to do about Tim? I turn to my left. Mr. Dice, I don't know. You've been very accommodating, very accommodating. You keep trying to help him. I know. I remember. I was there. For about 30 seconds, I talked to myself. With myself, but we hadn't covered prepositions yet. So after my dialogue, I look up. And the class is silent as Tim is sitting in his chair with his eyes wide, just looking at me. And I keep on teaching. Didn't have any more problems with Tim that year. Whenever he did show up, he sat in the seat. He listened. He did his work. And the best part of this is that this response seemed to spread to the other students in my class. The next day, Dreon, one of my favorite students, was in the back of the room. It was during silent work time, and he raised his hand with a question. So I came back, and I helped him out. And after I explained whatever he had a question with, I said, hey, Dreon, does that make sense? Do you have any more questions? And he looked up at me, and he said, yeah, Mr. Dice, I got one. You a serial killer? And I said, Dreon, what are you talking about? What a weird thing to ask somebody. Why would you ask me if I'm a serial killer? What are you talking about? And he said, well, you're always smiling. You never really get mad. You like classical music. And yesterday, when you were talking to Tim, I think your brain broke. So I leaned a little bit. I lowered my voice. I said, Dreon, maybe. And walked away. And so it was that with the threat of insanity and murder, I passed my first test as a teacher.
Right. All you have to say now is good evening, Clarice. And you'll be in great shape. I love that story. I love that story. And, I taught English, high school English, many, many years ago. And athletes are always entertaining. They don't think of themselves that way. Not on the field either. Necessarily, because I remember having a student like the one you're describing in an English class, and I asked the question, what's a pronoun? And he says, in a real cocky way, it's a noun that gets paid to be in a sentence. And I thought, well, that was a pretty athlete-fueled reply. Very good, getting paid to be in a sentence. I don't know. I guess you had to be there. But yeah, it's they are entertaining. And I think that all teachers really need to learn to talk to themselves, because you're never going to lose an argument, right? And that's always a good thing.
Very true.
Your next story takes this comedy a little differently. It's a comedy in education, but it's a little, let's call it higher. That's more appropriate, right? You call this Vicodin at Bible study.
Yeah, so this story took place my second year of college. That year I had taken on a lot of new responsibilities. I had started working as a resident assistant in my dorm building, and I had started with a friend of mine, James. We'd started a Bible study for freshman students at our college. And I really was invested in both of these things. I wanted to do a good job at my job as an RA. I wanted to be proud of the work that I was doing. And as a Bible study leader, I wanted to create a space where people could come together, they could read the Bible, they could have discussion, they could grow together, they could explore their faith. And so it was, I guess I'd put a lot of pressure on myself at the very beginning of the year that both of these things had to start off strong. I wanted to set a good tone for the rest of the year. So one of the problems with this, at least as an RA, was that one of my jobs was to enforce the university's policies and rules in the dorms, which included the fact that students couldn't be doing drugs in their dorms. And for the innocent little Midwestern cherub that I was, the problem with this is that I had never smelled marijuana before. And so since this was the case for a couple other students on staff as well, what the university decided to do is they took us over to the university police station, where we went down into the basement, and a cop took out what I presume was a confiscated bag of marijuana, took out a joint, lit it, and started walking around this semicircle of all the RAs in our building to help us smell it. And so he gets about halfway around the circle next to my friend Chioma, who's sitting right next to me. And Chioma complains that she can't smell it very well. And so she decides to blow on the joint to get it to burn more brightly, at which point it explodes in the cop's hand. And all of the RAs in our building are sitting in this kind of in this basement with no windows, with a slight contact high, watching as this plume of marijuana ash rains down on all of us. We're promptly told to leave, and so we get outside, and perhaps not coincidentally, we're all pretty hungry at that point, so we decide to go together to dinner. So we walk over to the cafeteria, and I should have noticed at this point that things weren't quite normal. In hindsight, I think maybe there were some double takes from people walking past our table, maybe some whispers of like, is that the RA staff? Like, what is that really who that is? The reason we were giving this extra attention was the fact that we all smelled like we'd been hotboxing for about 5 hours before this, totally unbeknownst to us. What complicated this a little bit was that night was a Bible study. And so I finished up dinner, walked back to my dorm to get my Bible and my notes, and walked over to the place where we were having it to get set up. And so I'm there, I'm getting everything set up. I'm excited, I'm nervous, but I'm excited that night we're going over Romans 4, chapter 4, which is a very theologically dense, really important chapter in the New Testament. And so I was really excited for us to really dig deep into this text together. And as I'm setting up, my friend James walks in, and under one arm he's got his Bible, and under the other arm, he's got this jumbo pack of double-stuffed Oreos. And on his face is this wide, dead-eyed smile. And I look at him and I say, hey, James, how's it going? You feeling okay? Everything all right? He looks back at me. He says, oh, yeah, no, I'm good. I'm good. Yeah, no. I broke my hand today playing basketball, but that's okay. Because they gave me some Vicodin, and I had one. I had a few. And do you ever just like, just like look at your hand, just like look at it, like hand. And I realize that even though James has walked through the door, I'm still very much alone in the room. And that in a minute or two, a line of freshmen are going to file in. They're going to sit down, open their Bibles, and expect this profound, meaningful Bible study And I'm going to have to try to hide the fact for an hour that my best friend is sitting next to me, high at Bible study. So everybody comes in, we sit down, and we get things started with a prayer. And James offers to pray, and so he launches into a prayer, and he's very thankful for the basketball team and how well they're doing, and for the diversity of cereal in the cafeteria, and for these little mushroom cap things that they have some cheese in them or something. He's not quite sure what they are, but they're very delicious. And he really wants one right now, but he can't have one because we're in Bible study. And so this goes on for a while. He finally says amen. And it becomes my plan immediately. Just don't let James talk again. Just fill every silence, engage people, be very like attentive, make eye contact. Just let him sit there and munch on his Oreos and hope that he doesn't derail everything. So we get started and we get maybe two-thirds of the way through, three-fourths of the way through. And it's going pretty well, surprisingly. The conversation's been good and people are sharing. And James has gotten loose a couple times. He referenced something from Revelation about the apocalypse, something maybe from Leviticus about the proper way to sacrifice animals. You know, but more or less, I feel like we're on track. And I think, like, okay, we're going to make it. We're going to get to the end. This is going to be good. And people are going to come back. And you know, my hopes for the year are intact. And just as I'm about to ask for prayer requests and we're about to wrap up, to my left, James has been quiet for a while, but to my left, I very suddenly hear. And I look over, and James is sitting at his desk with his Oreos open, his packet of Oreos open on the desk. He's taking them one by one, and he's airplaning them into his mouth. And I realized that my dream is dead. This has to look super weird to all the little freshmen here. We freaked them out. I know they're never coming back, and this is falling apart. So we wrap up, and I break. I said, guys, I'm so sorry. Tonight was so weird. James he broke his hand. He accidentally had too much Vicodin. James doesn't register that I've said his name. He's still airplaning Oreos into his mouth. And in a vital moment of realization, I say, oh, also, and if you guys smell anything weird, and I tell them the story of the cop in the basement with the exploding joint, because I realized in that moment that the frightened little looks they've been sharing with each other throughout the entire Bible study are not necessarily just for James, they're also possibly for me. And as soon as I say this, this just wave of relief washes through the room. And everyone's like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for saying that. We were so freaked out. We had no idea what was going on. My friend John sitting across from me said, Justin, again, thank you. I was never coming back to this before you said something. Apparently, he and everyone else were very relieved to learn that only one of their Bible study leaders that night was high on drugs.
The creative repertoire that that is unpacked from the influence of a pill. Thank you, Lord, for my M&Ms. This is Hank Rubichek, and you are enjoying my guest storyteller, Justin Dice, on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT, Houston's Community Radio, 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. Justin, your next story is a bit of a detour. It's probably an appropriate word from the others. It's entitled Gertrude, Silver, and Roz.
Mm-hmm. So the first time I ever fell in love with a car, I was maybe, I think, in my early teens. I opened up a copy of Car and Driver magazine to a two-page spread of a V12 Aston Martin Vanquish. For those who aren't familiar, it's James Bond's car. So just envision something that exudes power and elegance and sophistication. That's an Aston Martin Vanquish. And I'd never really been into cars up until that point. My dad was very much a car guy from when he was very young. When he was a teenager, built himself a dune buggy out of an old Volkswagen Golf. He was always, or I think maybe it's a VW Bug. He was always tinkering with motorcycles and cars and dirt bikes. And this was sort of my, you know, looking at this Aston Martin and just seeing, like, I'd never seen anything that beautiful and functional. It was a machine, but it was also art. And that was kind of my introduction to this. And we began to be able to talk about our love of cars with each other. Growing up in Michigan, he took me to the Detroit Auto Show once. We'd watch Top Gear together. We'd share, you know, pictures and stories about cars. But we had very different tastes when it came to cars. He liked the American muscle cars of his youth. He was all about quarter mile times and burned rubber. And I liked Aston Martins and BMWs and Audis. I liked, you know, the Northern European kind of, you know, elegant power. And we'd, you know, give each other a hard time. You know, he'd tease me about, you know, frou-frou European cars I liked. And I'd give him crap about the, you know, the caveman muscle cars that he preferred. But it was an opportunity for us to have fun and enjoy you know, this thing together. But up until I was, you know, through my teens, that was really the only engagement I had with cars, was, you know, looking at them and talking about them. And I was really excited to turn 16 when I finally was going to be able to drive them. I remember my 16th birthday. There were a number of gifts that, you know, I was given. We exchanged, but there was one that looked like a very small, thin box. And I remember opening that one last. My parents told me to open that one last. And I unwrapped it. It was a little black box. I opened the box, and inside was a BMW keychain. And I remember I looked at my mom, and I remember the look of her face as it went from joy to being stunned to horror. And she realized, she said, no, we're so sorry. We know you like BMWs. We thought you'd like the keychain. We're not getting you a BMW. You're going to get Gertrude. Now, Gertrude was, at the time, my sister's car. Gertrude was a 1997 Ford Taurus. And my sister had named her Gertrude because, as she described it, the color of the car was goat crap brown or goat crap tan. So Gertrude, the goat crap tan Taurus, became my first car. And I was, I think, understandably very disappointed that I thought for a moment I was getting a BMW and that I had to drive Gertrude. But Gertrude actually grew on me over the years. She was quirky. She had personality. Her electrical system was pretty much shot. So sometimes the windows would work and sometimes they wouldn't. And sometimes the locks would work and sometimes they wouldn't. And the radio and the lights. But one thing that always worked on Gertrude, unfortunately, were the interior lights, in that they never turned off. And so you would drive down the car feeling like you were in a fishbowl because you were lit up for the whole world to see. This was the one legitimate complaint I had with Gertrude. And I decided to try to fix it one day. I was driving back from a friend's place out in the country, and it was dark, and I just couldn't see anything out of the windows. And so I just pulled the light out of the ceiling. And then I could see, and it was fine. And then once the wheel well lights all burned out, I had to keep a flashlight in the car, because otherwise couldn't see anything. So with all her quirks and foibles, Gertrude actually ended up being a great first car. I drove her through high school, through college, and into my first job, when unfortunately a distracted driver blew a stop sign. And while I walked away and was totally fine, Gertrude sadly died that day. So after I, you know, went through my little mourning period for Gertrude, I started to think, like, okay, well, maybe now this is the time we can actually get a car I really like. As a first-year high school English teacher, Aston Martins were off the table, but I thought something, you know, fun, something sporty, something maybe like a Volkswagen Golf would be a great, great car. The problem with this was the reality of my finances. And as I kept looking for cars and as I, you know, kept pining for something cool, I kept coming back to my bank statement. And unfortunately, at the same time, my grandmother was getting ready to stop driving. And so she decided to give her car to my sister. And so suddenly my sister's car was available. And at the time, my sister was driving a 2005 Buick LeSabre. If you're unfamiliar with those, picture sin and just something uglier than that, just like one step uglier than sin. That's a Buick LeSabre. It's the most rotund, frumpy-looking thing you can imagine, the antithesis of an Aston Martin. It screams, I have arthritis and I wear diapers. That's the message it sends to the world. And so I did not want to drive a Buick LeSabre. And the whole reason it was even in my life and it was a possibility was unfortunately because of this sort of rivalry my dad and I had developed between domestic and foreign cars. He had a habit of, you know, teasing me and with, like, you know, by praising these cars he knew I just absolutely hated. And top of that list was the Buick LeSabre. And so when my sister was looking for a new car after Gertrude, he had actually encouraged her to buy one of these. And I still believe purely to spite me. She didn't realize that he was joking. And so she went out and she bought a Buick LeSabre. So here I was, I need a car. I'm dirt poor. And here comes this car essentially free. And so I finally caved and I bought the Buick LeSabre for my sister. My only kind of solace in this was the idea that, okay, well, maybe I'll actually end up liking it. You know, I didn't like Gertrude when I first got her and she grew on me. And so maybe it'll be the same thing. Unfortunately, no such luck. The car got the name Silver, not because it was silver, which it was, but because I was driving around with a friend one time complaining about the fact that whenever I hit the gas pedal, the car would have to think and say, I'm supposed to do something now. I know that. But what? Slower? Stop? Fast? Oh, faster. I have to go faster. And then it would accelerate. And so I was complaining this, talking about this, and I was demonstrating it. So I hit the gas pedal, and he from the passenger seat says, hi-ho, Silver, away! And then it starts to accelerate. So Silver and I lived together for a couple years, up until the point where it was a teacher. I had my summer free, and I decided I was going to take a road trip around the country to see some friends I hadn't seen in a while. I thought, okay, this is it. 3 months on the road, this will finally be the bonding experience that I've been hoping for. Unfortunately, eating, sleeping, drinking, spending every moment for 3 months in this car, at the end of it, still couldn't stand it. So I was actually somewhat of a relief when I was heading up a hill at one point, and Silver tried to kill me. The brake lines rusted through. If I going downhill, it would have been a very different story. But it was something that was irreparable. The car was totaled. And so finally I could get a new car. And so I looked around, I did my research, I did some test drives, and I ended up finally with a 2015 Volkswagen Golf named Roz. And I imagine the moment I drove away from the lot with Roz, I left Silver behind, never to see him again, was one of those joyous moments of my life. It was, I think maybe a month later though, I was went to CVS to pick up a prescription. I went in, I came back out to my car and I looked up from my phone to see where I thought my car was. And instead was a 2005 Silver Buick LeSabre with Indiana license plates, which is where I'd moved from. So that's what Silver had on it. And for a split second of horror, I thought, it was all a dream. This is still my life. I'm still driving this awful car that I can't get away from. Fortunately, I looked around a van that had been blocking my view, and there was Roz sitting there, listening and perfect. Roz is still with me. And she's even done a very admirable job of convincing my dad that, you know, he drives a Ford F-150. But after driving Roz a couple times, he's announced that the next car he buys is going to be a Volkswagen Golf.
Very cool. Very, very cool. Well, you know, you put Gertrude, Silver, and Roz together, you have Christine, don't you? You got something spooky. Christine, don't you remember? You know, Christine is the, the spooky car.
The spooky car. Oh, yes, 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 that's it. Okay.
Yeah. What's the matter with you, you English teacher? You know, Stephen King, Christine. Yeah, uh-huh. Listeners are asking the right thing. Who the hell is Christine? Who's he right. talking about? Look it up, everybody.
Yeah, I'm just playing the role of the listener as well.
But you got beauty, you got magic, you got horror, you got Christine. Mm-hmm. Those are your three cards. It's also a great story. It's a great story because it's really, it's a story about, you know, something that you found that connects with your dad. And, you know, mm-hmm. looking for something that connects is mm-hmm. always, always a good thing. We are listening to some funny stuff, but you know what isn't funny? Wanting to tell stories, but not knowing how or where. But here's your answer. It's our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. It's a great way to develop the skills that you need. All you have to do is to zoom into our monthly story swaps, the fourth Tuesday of every month, by accessing the link on our website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Our next swap is April 27 from 7 to 8:30 p.m. And while you're on the site, why not become a member? It's easy. And enjoy all the So What's Your Story program since 2008 under radio program on the menu on that Guild site. Yeah, 2008. Where have you all been? Well, for now on, right here on Thursday night at 8. How's that? Please do visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page for guest and program information. And if you have any ideas for a show or a guest, maybe even yourself, please drop us a note at story@kpft.org. We promise to get back to you. And we would love it if you like us when you leave. Our Friends of the Moth may not be packing into Warehouse Live, but themoth.org is still one of the best places to tune in for some of the best stories on the planet. And for something very special, why don't you check out StoryCorps Podcasts? Also, if you're interested in taking your storytelling skills to the next level, become a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. Let's build a little bridge between comedy and tragedy with, tragic comedy. It's a story called Road Trip with Suzanne.
Mm-hmm. So this story starts in Cambridge, England, on a warm July evening, walking down a cobblestone street. It was the first time I met Suzanne. We had just gotten out of our first creative writing class together. We were studying abroad that summer. And I had worked up the courage to kind of walk up to the cute girl in class and strike up a conversation as we were walking through town to where the dorms were. And Suzanne and I started chatting, and as we walked, the other people in the group sort of paired off as they got to the dorms until it was just the two of us. And we realized that we were the only two people that lived in the dorms furthest from campus. So it became our tradition to walk to and from class together every week. And over the course of 2 months, I learned that Suzanne was not only gorgeous, but she was also really funny. She would get this wry little smile before she said something clever. She was intelligent. She was creative. She was principled. She was brave. And she was soon to be married, soon to be engaged, to her boyfriend of 5 years. And so as hard as I fell for Suzanne that summer, I didn't say anything. After we went home, over the next couple of years, Suzanne and I kept up, and I heard about her breakup from this boyfriend and her move to Northern California. And I heard about when she met her new boyfriend, Lars, or whatever. He was a Norwegian ski instructor, had a great beard. And a couple of years after our study abroad experience, I gave her a call, and I said, "Hey, Suzanne, I'm going to be traveling this summer. And all my flights are coming through San Francisco. Are you going to be around? Do you want to hang out?" And she said, "Well, actually, I'm selling everything I own, going on a two-week road trip around the state, and then moving to Norway to start grad school and be near Lars." And she said, "Do you want to come on the road trip?" And I thought, well, that doesn't seem like an emotional minefield. You know, I'm over her. And so I said yes. And that summer, I flew out, and I found myself getting picked up by Suzanne from the airport and we set off on our adventure together. A couple days in, we were up in this cute little mountain town in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it was my birthday. And so Suzanne and I, we went to this gourmet restaurant. It was a touristy town, so they had a really nice restaurant there, and we got a fantastic meal. We went, we got a bottle of wine, and we drove up to this overlook in the mountains that we'd heard about. We got up there, and it was just the two of us, and the sun had set. The moon was full, and the stars were bright, and Suzanne and I sat on the hood of her beat-up Toyota Corolla and shared this wine and looked out on the mountains at night. And we were sitting there, you know, joking and laughing and telling stories, and I looked over at her, and she was laughing, and the moonlight was in her hair, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm not over her. I'm actually accidentally on the most romantic date of my life with her, and for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be stuck alone in a car with her, and she's with someone. Again, and as much as I want to say something, I don't. We finish our wine and we go back down the mountain. A couple days later, we found ourselves in Lake Tahoe on the beach, seeing Shakespeare performed. And the backdrop to the play was the crystal clear blue waters of the lake and the mountains all around us and the setting sun. And it was a Midsummer Night's Dream, which was not lost on me in the moment. We're having the best time. We're enjoying the play. And about halfway through, again, I look over at her, and she smiles at me. And it feels like a hot knife just goes through my chest. A couple days later, we end up in, we go to Napa Valley, and we go to these vineyards. We go wine tasting. We camp out at night underneath the stars. And we share wine around the campfire till late at night, swapping jokes and stories and enjoying each other's company. We then go back to San Francisco and we spend a couple days there, and we find great restaurants and great bars, and we see the water. We have, you know, get the best sushi. We then go down the coast to Monterey, where she grew up, and we find her childhood home that she hasn't seen in years. And she shows me the bar where her her grandpa used to drink with Steinbeck. And we take the coast road. We keep going south. We take the coast road, and it's right, you know, on the edge of the coast. And around every bend, there's this new incredible vista of the cliffs disappearing into the water, and waterfalls coming over the road sometimes. And it was just beauty overload. Your brain couldn't take it. After eventually you just became numb to how incredible the scenery was. And we finally got down to Big Sur on the coast, and camped out there for a day or two. And there we found this great overlook up on a cliff. So we went up there, and I imagined that if Lars were there, I could maybe, you know, give him a little push and see how well he and his skis could ski down a sheer cliff face. But it was just the two of us. And we're standing there, and we're looking at the ocean, and in the distance, we see this pod of whales that are breaching and slapping the water with their tails. And a little closer is this school of dolphins that are zipping around and interacting with some kayakers who are out there. And closer to shore, there's this family of seals that are barking and playing in the waves. And we're looking out at just the most amazing sight we've ever seen in nature. And Suzanne turns to me and she says, "Justin, I've lived in California my entire life. I've never seen anything like this. This is really special." And we stood there for hours. And we were quiet. And it was perfect, and it was awful. Over the course of the past week, there'd been these moments that Suzanne and I had shared, these looks, these silences, these just these things that made me think, like, does she know how I feel? What's more, how does she feel about me? Should I say something? Should I not say something? And we're standing on the cliff. The wind's in her hair, and it still looks great. And I look over her, and I want to tell her how I feel. I want to grab her. I want to kiss her. And she's with someone. And I don't say anything. We end our trip in San Diego, where she went to school. So I get to meet some of her friends. We spend a couple days on the beach, and everyone's having a great time. But all I can think about is the fact that in a couple days, I'm going to fly home, and I don't know if I'm ever going to see her again. And the last day comes. Finally, we get everything packed up in her car, and she drives me to the bus station. I'm going to catch a bus up to LAX and fly home. And we're standing in line waiting for the bus, and we're talking about the most amazing 2 weeks that we've had. We've seen just the most beautiful sights of nature we've ever had. We've had great wine and wonderful food, and we've laughed, we've joked, we've gotten along so well, we haven't fought once. We're talking about how rare it is to find someone that you just connect with so naturally. We finally get up to the bus, and I throw my bag underneath, and I turn to face Suzanne. She gives me a big hug. She pulls back. She says, "I love you, Justin." And I finally get to say what I've been meaning to say, but I don't get to say it how I mean it. I look back at her, and I say, "I love you too, Suzanne." And we're quiet again. Before I turn and I get on the bus and I ride away.
Yeah, you know, it's I've heard that story several times. That was your grand slam tale. And I got to tell you, it's that last line that always gets me. Mm. And then I finally get to say something, but I don't get to say it the way I want. Right? Mm-hmm. That is so powerful. And it says everything about human expression and how very, how vulnerable we are. That is such a great story, such a beautiful story. It makes the Le Sabre look very easy, my friend. Silver Le Sabre, right?
Yeah.
You know, transitioning to tragedy is always a hard thing, but it's part of the life cycle. And this one is a tough one. It's called Hit and Run.
So this story took place my first year as a teacher. It's a very eventful year. I had just started teaching at a school in Indianapolis and was really overwhelmed. The workload, the number of students, the amount of responsibility, I'd never experienced anything like that. And I was really just trying to keep my head above water. couple months in, it was we just done midterms. And I was trying to get all my grades in for that cycle, for that grading cycle. And I was at school late at night. Grades were due, I think, the next day. And it was, I think, 2 a.m. And I was trying to get everything in the grade book. And I realized that I couldn't even see straight. I was so exhausted. I had to go home and get a couple hours sleep. And I'd come back, finish up my work, and teach the next day. So I load, my stuff into my car, and I head out. And I'm just thinking about how exhausted I am and how much I want to get home and just collapse on my bed. And I take a turn to get on the road leading out of the city. And as soon as I turn right, I have to swerve to avoid something in the road. And I sort of do a double take, and I pull off to the side of the road, and I look back, and there's a woman running past my window on the sidewalk, and she's on her phone. And she said, "You have to send an ambulance. There's someone lying in the road." And so I pull off into a Wendy's parking lot, and I run after her. And I get there, and we're the first two people on the scene. And thankfully, she's a nurse, and so she gives me the phone, and I'm talking to the ambulance, and she's doing chest compressions. And we realize that the guy, he has a pulse, but he's not conscious. And so she's trying to resuscitate him, and I'm trying to, you know, give information to the ambulance, and other people start showing up. And so I'm aware that I want to be helpful, but I don't want to get in the way. There are people there who know better what they're doing. And so I start to kind of wave down traffic to make sure that everyone's kind of steering clear of where we're at. I kind of wander back towards the body lying in the road. And I'm thinking, okay, like, what do I do? I want to do everything I can to be helpful here. And kind of I get a sense that this kind of small voice in the back of my head says, well, kneel, lay your hand on him and pray. And I look down at this guy, and he's maybe in his early 50s. He's dressed very shabbily, and there's a bit of a smell. And the part of him that's closest to me is his foot, which his shoe's been kicked off in the collision, and he's wearing this sock that seems almost crusty with grime and dirt. And so instead of kneeling, I just simply bow my head and I begin to pray. At this point, the paramedics arrive, and so the nurse steps back, and they bag him. They start doing chest compressions. They're trying to get him back. And again, I'm standing there praying, and this voice in my head says, no, Justin, kneel, lay your hand on him and pray. And so I kneel, and I'm closer to his foot, and the stench is stronger, and I simply clasp my hands and I keep praying. And right away I feel, no, put your hand on him and pray. So I finally reach out and I grab his ankle, and I start praying. I'm praying for him, and I'm praying for the paramedics, I'm praying that he would come back. And after about a minute or two of this, I'm told I need to step back because they're about to use the paddles. And so they rip open his shirt, and they charge the paddles, and they zap him once, twice, three times, and then they call it. And they pull a sheet over him. And a police officer asked me to give my statement, and I tell him what I saw, and he tells me that I need to leave because this is about to become a murder scene, and if they're going to lock it down. So I walk back to the Wendy's parking lot, and I get in my car, and I try to put the key in the ignition, but I realize I'm shaking so violently that I can't. I'm sitting there thinking, like, I was just there with this person as they were dying, and the most loving, helpful thing I could think to do was to pray for them, and I hesitated. I didn't want to because he was dirty. It was just, I felt awful. I finally calmed down enough that I started the car up, and I drove back home. I collapsed on my bed, and I realized my mind was racing. I just realized, okay, there's no way I'm sleeping tonight. I can't teach tomorrow. So I get up and I send an email to my boss, explain what happened. I say, I'm sorry. I just for late notice, but I need a sub. I go back. I try to lay down again. I realize, again, I'm not going to sleep. And so I decide to drive back to school to get some things ready for the sub so that my students have something to do that day. So I get back to school, and I'm working there. It's maybe 5 or 6 in the morning. And my friend Ken comes in. He's another teacher at the school. And we shared a classroom for certain hours of the day. So he came in early to get some work done as well. And he noticed that I was still in my same clothes from the last day, and eyes were bloodshot. And so he asked me if I was okay. And I told him the story. And afterwards, he sat down next to me and said, Justin, like, you don't need to feel guilty about that. It was a traumatic experience. It was, you were in the moment. Like, anyone would have hesitated like that. But you really, really, it's okay. And I thanked him for his reassurance, but didn't quite feel better at that moment. So Ken sat down, and we both got back to work, and maybe 10, 15 minutes later, we're sitting there working, and there's this loud crash from the floor above. There was a classroom above us. It sounded like someone had maybe knocked over a table or some chairs, and kind of both looked up startled. We looked at each other, kind of looked at me and goes, gosh, who died? And immediately his face just went white. And he just, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to. And I just started cracking up laughing. I couldn't control it. I started laughing so hard. I was crying. I almost fell out of my chair. Ken starts laughing and we're just cracking up together. I told him that if I ever got to meet his wife, it would be the first story I would tell her. I still haven't. Maybe that's why. But it was just this cathartic experience of like all this tension and all this angst, and then it just broke in that moment. And it still took me a couple of weeks to feel back to normal again. It wasn't until I was driving home again one day and I passed the bus stop where it had happened, and there was a woman there waiting for the bus, and I realized that she was there and she was going somewhere else. And I was there and I was going somewhere else too. And now, when I fail, as I do, to live up to my expectations or what I think I should be doing in helping people without hesitation and being selfless and not being afraid to get dirty, I know to seek out a friend to share that with who can make me laugh and make me feel a little bit better.
What a powerful, powerful story. You know, there are a lot of parables in every story, and I know that, and maybe you've already shared it in that final assessment, but if there's one takeaway, one message that you want listeners to understand from this narrative, what would it be?
I'm not sure if this is, you know, the main one or the only one, but I do think, you know, that experience did teach me the importance of, you know, sharing those things with other people. And that would be my encouragement to the listeners.
Yeah, and that's a powerful one. When you heard that it was a murder scene or a potential murder scene, how did your mind shift at that moment?
I guess it sort of crystallized what had really happened there in the moment and in the immediacy of what was going on. You know, I guess I just wasn't thinking that much about anything other than what was right in front of me. And so the fact that this was part of a story that someone had come and hit this guy and just kept going, that is when that finally hit me, and the significance of it all, I think, you know, settled in.
Right. You know, there are people, listeners, who are going to say, you know, I don't really have a story to tell. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them?
Well, a lot of my students are like that. So, but you know, what I typically say to them is, I think what makes a story an effective or an engaging story is, the universality of it. And I think conflict is a big part of that. I think, you know, having a character who wants something and who can't get it, who's faced with some challenge or some difference between who they are and who they want to be. And I think I know everyone has experienced that in their life, and everyone has stories about how they've experienced that conflict and how they've tried to grow through experience.
Yeah, it's really about it. And conflict is the key word. You know, no conflict, no story, really. Mm-hmm. No conflict, no story. And it's really about vulnerability. I've always thought that vulnerability is really the greatest common denominator, at least in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the merging of comedy and tragedy that inspired English poet Kilroy Ulster's Dead Told Scrolls. And he says, storytelling creates a healing serum. Our personal stories represent a fusion of truths that each of us must discover within ourselves. And Justin Dice, I think you do this effortlessly. Thank you very much for demonstrating the methods by which stories connect. And for me, showing us that stories give form to our lives. And I hope we get you back here real soon. I'm sure we will, huh? It's been a couple of times. It's been a couple of times, but we'll get you back here again. Don't you dare move. Don't anybody move, because Lars is up next with the Tennyson tape deck. And he's up here with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story and Treasure What You Hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubichek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Pacifica Radio is doing what it does best.
And the rich white companies are jumping the line so they can get access to the vaccine.
Covering the global pandemic.
I think people need to wake up and recognize that this is a fight against slavery.
The working class movement against racism and imperialism.
If we have a First Amendment, it needs to extend from government to how these big tech companies are basically run by proxy in the public sphere.
And holding politicians and corporate media accountable to the people. This and much more on COVID, Race, and Democracy. Mondays at 2 p.m. here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Don't miss it.
This is Juan Gonzalez from Democracy Now! Please don't forget to wear your mask whenever you go out. Protect your family, protect your friends, and protect yourself.
You will have the opportunity to vote in a referendum for 30 days starting June 7th to replace the Pacifica Foundation's bylaws with new bylaws proposed by a group of Pacifica members. If adopted, significant modifications will be made to the Foundation's governance structure affecting both the national and local station boards, including how you, as a listener sponsor, are represented and can participate. To assist you in navigating the complex issues, a graphics-based voter guide can be found on elections.pacifica.org. Alongside the text of the current and proposed bylaws. In order to be eligible to vote, check that your membership is up to date by verifying with your station that you have contributed $25 or performed 3 hours of volunteer work between April 8th, 2020 and April 7th, 2021. It's Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, KPFT, and FM HD1 in Houston.
The Pacifica Foundation utilizes station boards to progress its utilization by the communities it serves. KPFT's local station board has many committees you can participate in or just observe. Participation by the public is encouraged. Committees include finance, outreach, management selection and review, and other critical decision-making bodies. The local station board members serve on these committees where business is conducted using Robert's Rule of Order. To view a complete schedule of listed meetings, ratings for all Pacifica, including those for KPFT, point your browser to kpftx.org. Attending meetings is a good way to engage, and many have become more interested in board service by taking this step. Pacifica listeners that pledge a minimum of $25 per year get to vote for its board members, become radioactive, and become a listener.